Now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this morning, Gemma B. from Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Gemma B. I'm an alcoholic. Love you too. I want to thank the host committee for an incredible weekend, and also for the tremendous honor of being able to speak with you. I also want to thank my sponsee Thea B for putting me up to this in the first place. I am originally from New York. I live in Los Angeles now. Yes. I'm an only child. My father is a therapist. My mother is a bishop. My father is an Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mother is an Al-Anon. A little bit of how I got here. I come from a really happy home, and I don't say that to brag in any way. I say that because if my parents could have loved alcoholism out of me, if they could have given me enough knowledge, they would have. But here I am. I was raised in AA. I went to lots of meetings as a kid with my dad, and he got sober when I was 5, and around that time is when I had my first drink. It was communion wine, and you know, I just felt like everyone else had the handbook for life, and I didn't have it. And I remember having like a particularly bad 5-year-old day, and and having communion wine and knowing that like everything was gonna be okay, that I had a spiritual experience. And, you know, I remember as a kid watching All About Eve, and I remember seeing Bette Davis, and I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, I wanted to be a nasty, fall-down, angry drunk. I heard someone say yesterday that no one wants to be an alcoholic when they grow up. I did. Sorry. That was my plan. And when I was a little girl, I used to put on a slip, and I would go into my room with a martini glass, with water. 9 years old, I would line up my dolls. I would drink from the martini glass, and I would hurl insults at them. I am sorry to say that that little girl's dream did not come true. Sad story. I got sober when I was 19 years old. I got sober not because I had lost everything, not because I was done, not because I had any interest in being a better person, and certainly not because my dream of being a fall-down alcoholic had gone away. I got sober because I went out for one beer with a coworker, and that turned into one drink in every bar on St. Mark's Place in Manhattan. And that turned into really bad alcohol poisoning. And I think people in this room will understand that there's a special kind of humility you get from throwing up for 14 hours. And, you know, My sober dad happened to be in the city that day, and he called and he said, "You want to go to lunch?" And I said, "Sure, but you have to come to my house and it has to be a plain bagel." And he came over and I'd been throwing up for hours, and I had marks on my forehead and my chin from the toilet seat from going back and forth and back and forth. I'd been lying on the bathroom floor all night. I had tile marks on my face. I was a vision for you. And my dad gave me a plain bagel, and I told him everything. And when you tell your sober dad everything, which included, I never want to do this again, you know, which would have passed. But I gave him a lot of specific details in that moment and over that lunch. And, you know, a few days later, I was feeling better. He didn't mention anything about getting sober or AA or anything. In fact, he offered to buy me a beer so I could get to work. And I was like, he gets it, you know. And I think it's the only time I ever turned down a beer. It was just too weird. But I went to see my parents a few days later, and my mother said, you know, I think that if anything ever happened to you, I don't know what we would do, but if I thought that there was something I could have done and I didn't do it, I wouldn't be able to live with myself. And she said, we're making a lot of sacrifices to send you to college, and we don't think you're going to live, and it is not a good investment. So the deal was, if I wanted to go to school, I had to get sober. And so I was really here on a tuition program. And I was not happy about it. When I got here, I was so angry, and I felt like my life was over. And I felt like because I got sober young, I should be able to have special arrangement, you know, like I should only have to do 6 steps. And I didn't want to have to get a sponsor, and I just did this thing my own way. And I wouldn't have made it, except that someone told me about this little meeting that had just started in New York. It was called Never Had a Legal Drink. That meeting saved my life, because I had this huge resentment for being here early, and I had this big loophole, you know, I'm too young to be here. And when I went to Never Had a Legal Drink, and that meeting was tiny, it had just started, it took away that loophole. It took away that excuse that I had. And I learned in that meeting that my bottom is whenever I stop digging. You know, I have a lot of yets in my story, and that's totally okay. I met people there that worked this program really hard, you know, as if their lives depended on it. And I made trudging buddies there. And my life started to get much better, you know? And then, so I was going to meetings, you know, and I still had lots of doubts. And around 2 years, you know, like my life was better. It definitely had gotten better. You know, I was living with dignity and respect. Blah, 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 you know? It's around 2 years that, like, dignity and respect sort of loses its shine, you know? And I was going to a party this night, and I was, you know, and I just didn't want to be that girl who didn't drink one more time, you know? You know, it happened to me all the time where I would go to a party, and people would offer me a drink, and they would say, you know, you don't drink. And then all of a sudden, everyone would be like, she doesn't drink, you know, and I would be telling my 5th step to drunk people, and I'd be like, we think it's so great that you're sober. And I couldn't understand why that always happened to me. And now I know, you know, through inventory, that people would say, do you drink? And I would always say, not anymore, you know. International woman of mystery, ask me about it. And so I came up with a plan, right? I'm gonna go to this party, but first I'm gonna drink at home so no one has to witness me going out because it's so depressing. I'm gonna go out by myself, and then I'm gonna go to this party and I'm gonna drink. And I had a roommate, and I was in the freezer with this. He had this tiny like drop of vodka, and I was just gonna drink, you know, and just get it over with. And, you know, it says in the big book that there will come a time where there's nothing between us and a drink but a higher power, and that was my moment. I stood in front of that refrigerator for 45 minutes, daring myself to just drink, just get it over with, just do it, just drink. And I don't know what happened, but I had this thought, like, maybe I could just run this by my sponsor. And the amazing thing that happens here, where you want to kill yourself, and then you're able to tell another alcoholic, and within 5 minutes, you're laughing about it, you know? That's what happened to me that night. And I was able to put the alcohol away, and she said, you go to a meeting tomorrow, and you share about this. So the next day, I went to Perry Street, and I showed up late, and I didn't share about it. But there was someone there who shared, and he said, you know, when I had 2.5 years, I wanted to kill myself, and I did something different, and everything changed. And he didn't go into any detail. So I had to wait to the end of the meeting, and, I tracked him down, and I said, you know, what did you do? And he said, let's go for a walk. And I remember this like it was yesterday. We were in the village, and it was raining, and I was crying, and there was mucus, and I was a mess. And I was like, what did you do? And at the same time, I was sucking in, because, like, maybe he was the one. And he said, I stopped making it all about me. And I said, what do you mean? Instead, I stopped showing up at meetings late and sitting in the back with my arms crossed, wondering why no one came to talk to me. That was me. I only went to meetings if I was having a hard time. If I was having a good day, you know, I didn't go to a meeting. I came here to dump. I came here very entitled, and I would constantly share about all the negative things that were going on for me, but I would never share about the positive stuff. I shared about turning 21 for 7 months before it happened. I was sure that on my 21st birthday, the sky was going to rain vodka. I had been planning my 21 run since I was 8, and I turned 21, I had this wonderful party, it was filled with so many more people than it would have been if I wasn't sober. I never shared about that. I never went back to that poor meeting and said, you know, hey, worked out. He told me, you know, you have to be of service. Now, I'd been in the rooms for 2.5 years or so, 2 years. Service sounded familiar. I'd heard the word. But it always seemed so optional. You know, they would say, hey, if anyone wants to sweep up after the meeting, let us know. I didn't want to. So I didn't do it. I didn't identify with people who said, you know, I'm in this meeting and my disease is out there doing push-ups, you know? I was like, I think my disease is into yoga. I didn't feel like I was avoiding jails, institution, and debt, you know? And so after I talked to that guy, you know, I changed my sobriety that day in that I started to deal myself in and I started to get in the middle. And the weird thing that I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous is if you don't like it, if you hate it here, the answer is to get in the middle. And that's super counterintuitive because if you hate something, why would you get in the middle of it? But it is absolutely where I found, like, the freedom, you know? And but I still had this nagging voice, which is that I don't really have this thing, you know? I really my two obsessions were that I'm not an alcoholic and I want to drink, you know? And I couldn't really make the connection of how ironic that was. And so one day, you know, I had about 4.5 years, and I was plagued with this idea that, you know, I have a terrible program, and what I should do is I should go out and drink, and then I should come back and do it perfectly, you know? So I wanted to drink for my sobriety. And I went to this meeting, and there was a woman there, and she had gotten sober young, and she started to share, and she She started her qualification when she was born, and she talked in such amazing detail that like 20 minutes into her qualification, she was nine, right? Such detail. And it had absolutely nothing to do with alcohol. She just talked about alcoholism. And for the first time in 4.5 years, I heard my story. And I was able to realize that I have this thing. I was able to admit to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and that I deserved my seat and that I had earned it. And I started to cry really hard. And I started sobbing, and this guy came up to me at the break and he said, "Who died?" And I was really dramatic and I said, "A piece of me." But the part of me that died that day is the part of me that was constantly questioning whether or not I was supposed to be here. And since that day, I have never once wondered if I was an alcoholic. And what I heard that woman talk about was the disease of alcoholism, which for me centers in my mind. I don't have symptoms of alcoholism that I used to have when I was drinking, which included, but were not limited to, taking my shirt off in places that I should not take my shirt off. Crying at parties, usually your birthday, throwing up everywhere. I remember the day that I realized that you could make yourself throw up and then drink more, and sharing that with a non-alcoholic, and the look of horror on their face was an indication that there might be a problem. What she talked about were the symptoms of my alcoholic thinking, and I still have those symptoms today, and I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what that looks like for me. I have a perception. I have a perception of the world that it is twisted and it is off. I have very black and white thinking, very all or nothing. You know, if I get into an argument with a friend, I'm like, I'm not going to say anything. Or maybe I just will never talk to her again. You know, those are the two options that make sense to me. I have very obsessive thinking, you know. I have a thought and I think it again and again and again and again and again and again. And I like to think that I'm just thinking things through. But it's obsession. I have an alcoholic therefore in my mind that just says, wherever I am today, therefore I will always be. You know, if I have a cold, I have that feeling, well, this is how I am now. I have an alcoholic translator that I take with me everywhere that helps me interpret what you're saying to me, helps me figure out what you really mean. A few years ago, my husband came home and he said, "Did you buy cat food?" And I started to cry. And he said, "What did you just hear?" And I said, "You said I was a bad wife." But it's that little therefore, you know, like, I didn't get cat food. That means I don't listen. That means I'm not a good partner. That means I'm not a good wife. That means he's going to leave. That means I'm never going to find anyone. That means I'm going to be alone. And pretty soon, I am now reacting to the fact that I'm going to be alone rather than someone needs to go to Petco. I also have this thing, you know, the problem isn't the problem, you know. Another cat-related story. I was house-sitting, and I was house-sitting a gray cat, house and pet-sitting, a gray cat and a red cat. And I was in this beautiful home, and it was for a week. And a couple days in, I thought, I have not seen the gray cat in a long time. Where's the gray cat? What happened to the gray cat? And my mind started to work, you know, and I was like, the cat has been maimed. The cat is dead. And then I started to play out having to tell my friend, your cat is dead. And I played it over. How would I tell her? Would we have tea? How should I say this? Should we be sitting down or standing up? And I'm playing it over and over. Your cat died. I'm so sorry. And then I thought, oh my God, she's sober. She's going to tell people that I'm a cat killer. Then everyone in the rooms is going to know. And everyone's going to hate me. And, you know, it's going to be terrible. And I started playing this over and over. And, you know, I've heard this thing, you know, the most terrible thing I ever went through never even happened, you know. And so I tell myself these horrible stories. Meanwhile, I'm in a beautiful home, and it was like the worst week of my life. And on the last day, you know, I open the door. Who's on the doorstep alive? The gray cat. And my first thought was, where's the red cat? It's always something. It's always something. I have thinking that gets really fast. When my thinking is really fast, I know that that's my alcoholism. When something has to happen right away, that's my alcoholism. At 3 o'clock in the morning when I want to talk to my husband about finances, and I feel like God is telling me it's okay. Now that's alcoholism. It can wait. I have a disease that tells me I'm right around the corner from happiness, but I just need one more thing. My first 7 years of sobriety, that one more thing was a relationship. I'm going to be happy. I just need to be in a relationship. If I could be in a relationship, I would know, you know. There's this book, Are You My Mother? For me, it was, Are You My Boyfriend? And then there were the Are You My Girlfriend years. Are you my boyfriend? Are you my girlfriend? Are you? And I thought the only thing that I needed to make that voice go away was a boyfriend. And then I got a boyfriend. And then that voice just got a different line. And that line was, he doesn't like you as much as you like him. And then when I was sure that that wasn't true, then it was, you don't like him as much as he likes you. And then when I was sure that that wasn't true, it was like, you need to live together. You need to live together. And I was like, yes, we just need to live together. Then I would know that we really have a commitment. And then we lived together, and I thought, I just need a ring. I just need a ring, just so I know, you know, that we're getting married. I just need a ring. We just need a ring, a ring, a ring, a ring. And then I got the ring. And I thought, oh my God, this is really it, you know. And then I thought, he's going to die. And I would drive to work, and I would, by the time I got to work, I would have tears running down my face. And my coworkers would be like, what's wrong? And I'd be like, my fiance died in my head twice. Couldn't really tell them what was going on, but because it's crazy. And but then the voice was like, you know, you just need the wedding. The wedding just needs to go well, and then you can be happy. And then the wedding was beautiful, you know? And I enjoyed most of it, except for that one moment surrounded by all my friends and family when I thought, everybody hates me. So we were married, and I thought, well, with the honeymoon, we just need to know that the honeymoon is okay, and worried about that. And then we showed up after the honeymoon. We got home, you know, all married, honeymooned. And I looked around our apartment, and I thought, we cannot live here. We just need a house. And then I'll be happy. And then we got that little house, so cute. And there was an extra bedroom. I thought, we have to put a baby in that bedroom. And then we did. And his name is Olin, and he's beautiful, and he's perfect, and he's healthy, and he's amazing. And I remember being in the nursery with him and looking at him and thinking, all I need is a career. And it was when my son wasn't enough that I got it. It's never going to be enough. There is nothing that I can go out and get that is going to make my alcoholism happy. And I can keep going out there and getting stuff and bringing it to the altar of my alcoholism and being like, you told me to go get this thing, and I got it. And my alcoholism is never going to say, well done, I've got nothing to say. If anything, what I have learned is the more my dreams come true and the more people love me, the louder my alcoholism gets. My disease wants me dead, but it'll settle for me miserable. And it is through my thinking that my alcoholism makes me miserable. And so I have to be really aware of when I'm in my disease. Not so that I'm like, oh, I'm an alcoholic, so I can behave badly, because tee-hee. But so that I can recognize the problem so that I can get into the solution. When I was drinking, I thought that my drinking didn't affect anyone else. And I came to find out that that wasn't true. And in my sobriety, I can tell myself that my alcoholic thinking doesn't affect anyone else. And that's not true either. My alcoholic thinking absolutely affects other people because my thoughts turn into words and my words turn into actions. And I can behave alcoholically sober. The reason that I need to be in the solution, right, is so that I don't let my alcoholism get the best of me. And what my solution looks like is going to meetings, because alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and insidious, but it made one mistake, and that is that it's the same in all of us. And when I go to a meeting, I can hear it in you. I can recognize your alcoholism, and I can know that even though you feel alone and scared and like, you know, worthless, that I love you, you know? I can see that that's just your disease. Sponsorship is a huge part of my sobriety, you know? I have a sponsor who I check in with, who knows me, and I have sponsees, and I have grand sponsees that I got to meet this weekend. And, you know, sometimes my sponsees call me, and I get off the phone, and I think, wow, I'm brilliant. And sometimes I get off the phone and I think, it should be illegal for me to sponsor people. And like everything else, it has nothing to do with me, and it has absolutely everything to how willing they are. You know, I have some sponsees that like, they call me all the time, they touch base, it's like a blog, you know? They tell me what's going on, there's room for me to comment. And then I have other sponsees where it's like there's some reporter, you know, and they call me like, I'm calling you live from the scene. And then I have other sponsees where it's like a Christmas newsletter. Everything is in the past tense, you know, just checking in. I moved in with a newcomer, but he's different. In recovery, my problems come from my thinking. And so for me, sponsorship works when I run my thinking by my sponsor before and not my actions by them after. Service is a big part of my recovery, and working the steps, you know. For me, the first step was absolutely the hardest. It took me, as I said, 4.5 years to really do that. And then it was, you know, finding a higher power. And people would say, oh, do you have a higher power? And I would say, my mother's a bishop. And they'd say, oh, great. Glad you have one. Until someone said, you know what? My mother's an accountant, and I'm broke. I have found that a relationship with a higher power is like a relationship with anyone. You just have to put in the time, you know? It's like having a neighbor that you'd like to get to know, you know? Except the only time you talk, it's like, my house is burning down. But if I show up for that, you know, just to have coffee on a regular basis, that like you can build that relationship. The thing that has done the most good for my relationship with my higher power is my relationship with my son. He's 2 years old, and You know, I've always identified with this idea of a higher power as being a loving parent, but I didn't fully get what that meant until I became a loving parent. And I used to sort of think that, like, I was really connected to my higher power when I was getting what I want, but then sometimes he would just drop me. And what I learned from being a parent is that, you know, my kid hates to be taken care of, you know? It's like, when I'm taking care of him, when I'm feeding him, bathing him, it's like I'm hitting him with sticks. And he has, you know, toddlers are cute, but they have terrible ideas. And he has terrible ideas, you know, that involve scissors and falling, like, headfirst down cement stairs and eating bugs, you know. And when I stop him from doing those things, because I love him, he looks at me like, if you loved me, you would let me eat this bug. And how many times have I wanted something and my higher power was like, no, and I was like, if you love me, you would let me eat this bug. Last week, we took my son to his favorite place, which is the ocean. And which he pronounces as ochin. And we told him, all right, buddy, we're going to go to the ochin today, you know. And but first, we have to do four things before we go. We have to eat. We have to change your clothes. We have to put on sunscreen. And we have to pack up the car. And he was having none of it. And as we were doing these things, you know, I put down breakfast. And all of a sudden, you know, there goes breakfast across the room. And I'm chasing him around, you know, and I'm like, God, you know, you say you want to go to the ocean, but it doesn't seem like it. And he's having like a temper tantrum about this, you know. And finally, he's screaming and crying, and he just looks at me like, I just don't understand. And he's like, I want to go to the ocean. And I was like, we're going to the ocean. This is what going to the ocean looks like. I am not ignoring you. I am preparing you for what you want. And he's two. He didn't get it. But I got it. I totally got it. Like, this is how my higher power feels about me. All that time when I was like, I want to be in a relationship. Don't you understand? And I was in these situationships, you know? What are these? I want to be in a relationship. I want a career. And what is this, like, day job that I get that I have to show up every time? And my higher power was preparing me for what I wanted. And I eventually got those things. And if I had gotten those things that I wanted on the right when I got here, I would have messed them up. I wouldn't have been able to handle it at all. There is, in the third step, you know, when we talk about turning our will over to God, over to the care of God, another word for will is desire, and another word for care is protection. To me, I think of the third step as turning my desires over to the protection of my higher power. I do not know what's best for me. I have no idea. There are so many things that I've wanted that have not been what's best for me. So I just turn all of those things over to my higher power. When I had 4 years, I called my sponsor at the time, and I told her, I want to drink. And she said, where are you? And I said, I'm at the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you know, she's a sponsor. She's going to say, no, don't drink. And what she said was, what are you going to have? And I thought, wow, you're not good at this. And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, where are you going to get it? And I said, I don't know. And she said, honey, you don't want to drink. You want to feel better. And for me, those two things had always been the same, you know? And she said, let's think about this drink that you're going to have. She's like, let's think it through. What's going to happen? And then what's going to happen? And think about what you were like when you were drinking, not what you would like to look like when you were drinking, what you were like. What's going to happen? And then who's going to happen? And then where's going to happen? And we talked the drink all the way through to what it would mean. And then she said, do you still want a drink? And I said, no. And she said, well, what would make you feel better? And I said, a meeting. And she's like, well, let's try again. And I said, I want to go to a meeting? She's like, absolutely right, you know? And I was like, you are good at this. She also taught me to be careful of my language, you know? It's one of the best things that I've learned here, you know? Because I said, everyone is having a good time at this convention. She said, there's 65,000 people. Have you talked to everyone? And I said, no. And she said, well, who's having a good time? And I said, Ron. You know, we have this disease that's so dramatic, you know, and I'll say, like, everyone hates me. And I've learned, okay, like, who is everyone? Okay, you know, my boss, John, hates me. Does he hate me? No, okay, maybe he's mad at me. Why is he mad at me? I was late, you know? It's so much easier to think everyone hates me than I show up late, you know, because late I can do something about that involves getting up earlier and something I don't want to do, you know? And I'm really careful with my language. You know, my husband and I, we never use the D word. We don't even joke about divorce or taking off our rings, because even joking about it desensitizes me to it, and then it makes it easier to say in the moment of an argument, and then I'm going to be upset about the fact that we're getting a divorce, not, you know, a disagreement over a ladle or whatever it might be. True story. Your spiritual speaker got in a fight over a ladle this week. I just want you to know that. And my husband is a normie, and he's here. He flew up from LA to be here. And you know, I don't ever say that I'm a bad mom. You know, I in my Mommy and Me class, like, there were all these moms, and, like, if they forgot snacks, they'd be like, I'm a bad mom. And I don't even joke about that, because my alcoholism will hear that and then think I need to leave, you know, like, to protect him or something. I just don't even joke about it. I don't even go there. I'm really clear with my language and with my intent. A little story about when my husband and I first, before we had our baby, we moved into this house, this cute house that I was telling you about, and in the yard of this house, there was a lime tree, and I'm from New York, so having a tree that had, like, produce, you know, I felt like a farmer. I was so excited for our limes. And so we were having all these barbecues, and I would be like, whatever you do, don't bring limes. I was so proud of that. And we had our first barbecue, and I went out to the lime tree, and I got my first lime, and I, like, went to the cutting board, and I cut into it, and it was hard as a rock. And I was disappointed, but I was like, okay, you know, it's fine. My harvest is not ready. I will wait. And the next week, I went to my lime tree, hard as a rock, hard as a rock, hard as a rock. Every week, hard as a rock, the lime's not, you know, it's not happening. And I'm a good alcoholic, so I started to resent the tree. And then the tree became a symbol for how things don't work out for me. And then, you know, I started to resent citrus in general. And sort of, you know, summer ended, it sort of just left a bad taste in my mouth, the whole thing, you know, it was very disappointing and upsetting. And I came home one day in November, and my husband was in the living room eating an orange, and I knew I didn't buy it, and I was like, where'd you get that orange? And he said, from the lime tree. We go outside, And the lime tree is covered in oranges. For me, that is alcoholism. Nobody told me that that was a lime tree. It looked like a lime tree. And then I really wanted it to behave like a lime tree. And how many times in my life did I have relationships that looked like something and I was really angry at that person, you know? You were supposed to be the one and yet you don't know who I am, you know? This is supposed to be the job and someone else accidentally got my job. Being mad at those things for not being what I thought they were like being mad at oranges for not being limes, you know? It just was my perception. It was my perception that was off, not the other people. And I get resentful really easily, you know, as an alcoholic, and really easily. And so when it came time to do the fourth step, you know, I was my first fourth step. I was on it for 2.5 years. And when I say on it, I don't mean I was working on it. I just mean it was on every to-do list that I had for 2.5 years, but I didn't do it. And I would share about it in meetings, you know, and finally someone just said to me, you know, like, just give yourself the gift of getting it done. And I know now that she meant, give us the gift of you getting it done. I did not have a white light experience after my first fourth step, you know, I was going to do it wrong, I didn't have like a big, you know, it's just the next thing, it just led me to the next step and the next step and the next step. I made it such a big deal. What I learned is, like, you know, it's just an inventory, you know, it's like a store taking inventory. They count what they have, you know, like in a grocery store, they count what they have. How many cans of corn do we have? They don't look at every can of corn and go, this stupid can of corn. This idiot malfunctioning can of corn. You know, they just take an inventory. And when I, like, my thing in my inventory, it always, like, when I can't find my part, it always comes down to that sentence in the big book, where did I make a decision based on self that set me up to be hurt later on? That's my part finder sentence, you know? And it's usually something that I did where I thought that I could, you know, save time or, like, manipulate a situation. Like, I usually set the ball in motion in some place, you know? And I, to carry the citrus metaphor further, what I have found about resentments is that, you know, it's like lemon juice. If you get it on your hand and you don't have a cut, it doesn't hurt. But if you get lemon juice on your hand and you have a cut, it stings. And what I have found about resentments is that it usually has nothing to do with the other person. That other person is just doing what they're doing, you know? And it's the fact that I have a cut that I bring to the table, you know? I have a pre-existing wound. And for me, my big thing is I'm not good enough. And then what that person is doing gets in that wound and it stings and it hurts and I take it really personally. And it's usually not personal. And what I found in inventory is that I can go in there and I can write down my part. What is my part? What am I doing in this situation? Anytime I tell my sponsor, you know, like, this keeps happening, that's a time to do an inventory. If it keeps happening, there's usually, it's not just luck, you know? I usually have a part in anything that keeps happening. And the amazing thing about doing an inventory is I can find out what my part is and I can change. And I don't have to be a victim. Things don't happen to me like that anymore because I'm not a victim of you know, what other people happen to be doing. And I can improve relationships without the other person knowing. And you know when you do inventory on, like, a coworker or something and you just want to tell them, like, I did an hour-long inventory on you yesterday. But you don't really get to do that. But I've had relationships, huge, big relationships, important relationships in my life change completely because of inventory. And the other person has no idea that we even had a problem, usually. It's usually up here. The other thing that really helps me with resentment is to not have conversations with people who aren't in the room. That's a big one. Because I'm in my head a lot and I make a lot of stuff up, you know? And I'll be driving home and I'll think to myself, like, well, when I get home, I'm going to say this to my husband. And then he's going to say this. Well, then I'll say this. And then he'll say this. And then I'll say this. And then he'll say this. And I walk in the door and I'm like, screw you, I'm home, you know? And sometimes we'll be having a conversation and he'll look at me and he'd say, did we already have an argument about this in your head? You always do. So in the sixth and seventh step, I've heard it broken down that, you know, the sixth step is not doing the things we want to do, and that the seventh step is doing the things that we don't want to do. And, you know, I am a big proponent of contrary action, because a lot of times I don't wanna. Like, if it's something that's gonna be good for me, I don't wanna. And I always wanna do the things that I'm gonna regret later, but the things that are harder to do up front, I never wanna do. I've never, you know, been excited to like read literature, but I've never regretted it. I've never been like, God, why'd I read that literature? You know, I've never. And what I've learned about the seventh step is, like, I act better than I feel, and I ask myself, like, in any given situation, what would a woman who loves herself do here? And I just pretend to be the person I want to be. That's why I just, you know, it might not be my inclination to do something, but I just act better than I feel, I act like the woman I want to be. And what has happened is that one day I turned around and I was her. I also am big on like self-care. You know, we talk about when you're newcomers, like halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And when I had a kid, like I started to just think about my sobriety more than I worked it. You know, like I would wake up and I would think, this would be a good time to pray. Not gonna. You know, this would be something I should do an inventory of. Not going to. I should go to a meeting. Not going to. And there's a reason at the end that we don't say, like, it works if you think about it. I've learned here that I have to pursue my sobriety the way I pursued my drinking. And so whenever there's something in recovery that I don't want to do, I ask myself, if when I was drinking, there was like an open bar, would I do it? You know, like when I don't want to go to a meeting because it's raining, would I have let that get in the way of my drinking? No. You know, I was talking to a newcomer once and she was like, oh, I haven't talked to my sponsor. And I said, well, why not? And she said, well, I called her 2 weeks ago and she hasn't called me back. If that were your drug dealer, would you let 2 weeks go by and be like, I called him last, it's his turn, you know? So, you know, and then, so in like the eighth and ninth step, I'm sorry, I'm like the metaphor queen, but it's the only way I understand things. So what I think of the eighth and ninth step, I think about like having like a beautiful coat that I really love, right? And it's like, the type of coat can vary, but it's a light fabric and light color, and it has all these stains on it, right? And so in the eighth step, I look at this coat and I look at all the stains and I make a list of all the stains that are on this coat, you know? And I know from the inventory how I got those stains, what behaviors made those stains. And then I make a decision. I'm going to try and get these stains out. And in the ninth step, I try to do some stain removal. And, you know, some stains come right out. And some fade. And some don't come out at all. But I know with those stains that I've tried to fix, they don't come out. I still know that that area is clean. And I have to say, a big thing that's really important about stain removal is doing it with the guidance of a sponsor. You know, especially when you're new and you've just read that chapter. I heard this yesterday. You know, it can feel like you bump into someone and you think, oh, I'm going to make amends right here at this party, you know. The thing about making amends is you have to be really, really careful. And you have to do it with a sponsor, and you have to do it the right way. Because otherwise, if it's unsupervised and just your own ideas, it's like when you use one of those stain sticks, and not only does the stain not come out, but there's a stain around the stain, you know? I made so many bad amends, you know, like just because it just seemed right, you know? And totally unsupervised and you know, it wasn't good. And then I had to make amends for my amends, which is never fun. You know, and in so then, like, in 10, 11, and 12, like, people talk about those being the maintenance steps. And I've been told that they're the growth steps, you know? I do an inventory. I'd like to say that I do an inventory every day, but that would be a lie. I do an inventory when I'm in the mood for freedom, you know? And I've heard it said here that resentment, the word means, it comes from the word to feel. So literally what a resentment is when you're re-feeling something over and over. And so I know if I'm re-feeling the same thing, am I replaying something, I know that it's time to do an inventory on it and to make that thing right. And then with the 11th step, I have to say that I struggle with meditation. I like to think that the 11th step is prayer or meditation. You can pick or choose, you know, and meditation is something that I struggle with. But I do, you know, I do have a prayer life, and I've also heard that, like, prayer and it's like prayer is talking and meditation is listening. So of course I would have a hard time with that. And it's funny to me that I have so much time for so many things, you know, and like prayer is sometimes a struggle, you know, and sometimes I don't do the 11th step prayer because it's too long. You know, it's so long. And in the 12th step, like, I get to carry this message to other alcoholics, and I get to bring this out into my life, and I get to, you know, you never know if you're the only face of the big book that someone's going to see, you know? So I try to be a power of example, even if people don't know that I'm in AA, so that if one day they come to a meeting, they know, and they see me, they know that I live this out in the world too. I don't get to come here and say a lot of things and then go behave badly. Like, I try really hard to practice these principles, you know, in all of my affairs. When I first got here and I said that I was an alcoholic, I thought that that meant that I was broken. I thought that it was the same thing as saying, like, my name is Gemma and I'm damaged. What I've learned in the program is that I'm not broken. There are just some things that I do that aren't, I don't do things as well as I can, you know, and there are tools in this program to fix all of those things. I'm an alcoholic, right? So, like, by design, I should want to drink, like, all day, every day. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink in 15 years. I'm a selfish alcoholic, you know? Left to my own devices, I'm self-centered and self-seeking. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to form a true partnership with another human being. And on Friday, we celebrated 5 years of marriage. I'm someone left to my own devices. I can barely take care of myself, you know? But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm somebody's mom, and I'm good at it. And I'm someone who's scared to talk to people. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm talking to all of you. And I'm on big screen TVs. My husband and my son were watching TV recently, and we have this screensaver on our TV that has like pictures of animals, like safari, jungle, real animals. And they were watching the screensaver one time, because that's what you do with the toddler. And there were all these pictures of animals, and there was this picture of a lion, and she had her arm around another lion, and they were, it was a real photo, but it looked like they were smiling, and they were snuggly and cozy and cuddly. And my son looked at that picture, and he said, "Mama, that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not hardwired to be that person. It is because of Alcoholics Anonymous that my son thinks that that is his mother," sort of, you know what I mean? Because there's also a picture of an elephant stampede on that same screensaver, and that could just as easily be Mama. We are not broken. We're alcoholics. And we have a solution today, and absolutely anything is possible for us. It is absolutely possible to live sober, happy, joyous, and free. I want to thank you so much for this incredible experience, this incredible weekend. I hope that everyone gets home really safely and that you bring the love and the excitement of this weekend home with you and that you pass it on. Thanks so much.
Gemma B. from Los Angeles, everybody. How about another one?